Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. In this engaging and informative documentary film, Food and Country, director and co-producer Laura Gabbert examines the precarious state of America's food system, reaching across political and social divides through Ruth Reichel, the subject and our guide in this film. We get to meet farmers, ranchers, chefs, restaurant owners, and so much more. Through her eyes, we see the humanity and the struggle behind the food we eat. It is a remarkably well-done documentary film, Food and Country. We're joined today by the director and co-producer, Laura Gabbert. Laura, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Being introduced to Ruth Reichel, and as she guides us through this subject, through the many different aspects of food and food production and what we eat and why we eat it and the history of, it's just a really well-done documentary film. And what put you on to doing this? I know you've done a couple of other documentaries on food, so let's talk a little bit about that journey for you, but also to this point where you did Food and Country.
Sure. So I guess I'll answer kind of the first question first. Because I had made a couple of other food-themed documentaries, I knew Ruth Reichel a little bit because she is in one scene in my film called City of Gold, which is about the late, great food writer Jonathan Gold. So I knew her a little bit, and I was really beginning to actually shoot a short documentary about what was happening to the restaurants in Los Angeles as they were closing down in March 2020, the beginning of the pandemic. Ruth reached out to me and she said, "I hear we're working on something similar." And she said, you know, I told her what I was working on. She said, she immediately grasped that it was much bigger. She said, "Laura, this is going to impact the entire food system." Like, she knew this week one of lockdown. She understood just intrinsically because she's so well-versed in the food world and has been following it for so long and reporting on it and writing about it. She understood that it would affect supply chain issues. It would affect farmers and ranchers and fishermen. And, you know, it would basically kind of reveal what's broken about our system. And she was right. So we joined forces. And in the beginning, we mostly just, you know, if you'll remember at the beginning of the pandemic, we didn't know how long it would last. So we started recording Zoom calls Ruth had with folks that we were interested in talking to. At that point, it was chefs and farmers and ranchers. And then the pandemic went on and on and on. And as we watched the recorded Zoom calls, we started to feel like there was actually something kind of very immediate and very intimate about these calls. And even though we did go out and finally start shooting in the field with some of the characters, we decided to incorporate the Zoom recordings into it because they just captured something that's impossible to capture. Because we would get things in real time. Ruth would talk to these people every week or every other week. So as something happened, she would get it almost in real time. And then she also just built a very strong rapport and connection to a lot of these characters. So they really saw her as a confidant. My team and I were really struck by how intimate those conversations were. And even though Zoom calls are not pretty to look at on the big screen, we thought they still worked as almost like a virtual verite in a sense.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. They're unguarded moments in these conversations we see on Zoom with them, especially as we get near the end of the film, where the consequence of the full weight and of the pandemic and its impact on their business, on their life, and so much more really starts to kick in. And so you see this arc to the story. But there's more to the story than what I just mentioned as well. In addition to those interviews and getting to know these different people, as farmers, restaurateurs, growers, all of it. You also give us this history, which I think is very, very important to give the context to not only the racialized history of food production of the country, but how people who work in restaurants are impacted. There's so much here. And I want to talk about that because I don't think people really, they eat food and often have given no other thought, but just I'm satiated on some level.
Right. Well, I think that's one of the things, and Ruth says this in the film, she really has always, for 50 years, she's been writing about food, and she's been trying to get people to pay attention to it. Because food touches every aspect and every struggle in our society, whether it's income inequality or climate change or, you know, racial issues, racial, you know, inequality, the rural urban divide in our country. It just affects so much, so many different issues. Yeah. And I think that we really felt like we had to sort of include some of that history, because I think people need to know how we got here, basically. Yeah. Because we used to be an agrarian country. I mean, most of world history was agrarian, right? And most of American history was agrarian. And it used to be that everyone knew a farmer, you know? I mean, 100 years ago, everyone knew either an uncle was a farmer or a friend was a farmer or your family were farmers. Now, very few of us have any real connection to the people who grow and make our food. Right. And so I think our goal was let's get to know the people behind the food. And in doing that, will people care more? I think our hope is that people might start to care more about some of these things and think a little bit harder about, you know, when you pick up a tomato at the supermarket, where it comes from.
And in terms of my own personal perception of food production, the Great Depression for me was the break in our relationship to farmers and to food. I think after that, the post-Depression World War II era, once you get past World War II, it's about, as we see in the film, it's about more is better, not quality, but more is better and more convenient and less, you know, less essentially paying attention to what you're eating. It became the norm for the last several decades of American history, right?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And we have a couple sections in the film that really cover that, just to sort of remind people, because I think young people today actually really, many young people today appreciate food, right? I mean, people kind of see eating as a form of entertainment now, whereas 50 years ago, they didn't. You'd go to a restaurant for a special occasion. But I do think that, having said that, I think people don't really think about how it's actually grown. I mean, there are health conscious people who care about those things, and chefs care about it. But most people go to the supermarket and expect to see, you know, perfect apples and perfect broccoli.
Right. Absolutely right. And why it's important is multifaceted in terms of not just what you're eating, the nutritional value, the impact on your health, but of the impact on the health of the planet. And I'm so glad that that's a huge part of the telling of the story behind Food and Country, is sustainable futures. And the relationship in business is between the farmers, the business, the middlemen, the producers, the companies that control them, and then to our table, right? So that is a relationship so critically important to understanding so much more than just what we're eating. So thank you for that.
Of course. Yeah, my pleasure. I'm glad you appreciated those aspects of the film.
I'm old enough to remember Diet for a New America. Yeah. And we've been given plenty of warning, going back to Rachel Carson and just how she was telling us, the things that we're putting in the ground are impacting so much more than just that.
The people we focus on in the film, many of them are working outside of the agribusiness world, and they're free to innovate and pivot. So if a disaster happens, they can do that because they're resilient and smart and nimble. You know, but I think that what's tricky is that we're so entrenched in the system. It's a huge tanker that's almost impossible to move around. And I really think change is going to come from kind of the ground up. People like Will Harris of White Oak Pastures, you know, or Bren Smith, who's a regenerative ocean farmer, you know, and this idea of replicating these farms all over the country. I mean, that could start to happen. It could be a movement from the ground up. It's going to be hard to just dismantle the entire, you know, the way the USDA basically handles it, which is mostly they give, I think it's a third of their budget to farms, but mostly large monocrop farms, farms that actually don't grow food. They grow commodities.
Just want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with the director and co-producer, Laura Gabbert, of this wonderful documentary film called Food and Country. And it is...
We're in theaters here in New York and LA next week and across the country. We'll be screening in several other cities. So if people are interested, they can go to foodandcountryfilm.com and see our screening schedule. And we will be on video on demand on October 22nd.
Yeah. And that's by the way, Food and Country is being released through Greenwich Film Distributors, wonderful distributor. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you'll be able to watch in theaters, which I suggest you do, because there is some beautiful country being filmed in the course of this documentary, Food and Country. And that reason why it's in the title, it is beautiful country that we live in, and to see it in full bloom, especially, and I want to make sure I get to the gentleman, I believe he's from Georgia, and I've got his name right here, Will Harris and his farm.
Yes. White Oak Pastures.
Yes. White Oak Pastures. Again, that's the way forward. In this film, there's a number of people who are pointing directly to the right way forward.
Correct.
And in combination, you see from soup to nuts, you see all of it, all the way from the farm to the consumer, how we can be better.
And what Will Harris explains is that you know, they farm now like their great grandfather, his great grandfather did, not like his father. His father had turned, it's a sixth generation farm. His father had bought into industrialized ag, all of the sort of the terrible animal husbandry and poor practices that poison the earth and the water and the air. In the 90s, Will just sort of had a gut feeling, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. It doesn't feel good to me. And he very slowly, just step by step, started changing the way he sort of ran his farm.
And one of the great benefits of what he's done is also he's taken his farm from a carbon producer to a carbon net zero, or maybe better than that, actually.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, by the sort of, you know, regenerative land management, they are now sequestering carbon in their soil.
Yeah, that's great. So you not only, and I've singled out Will, but there's so many people in the film, all of them very compelling, all of them with they're part of the story. Karen Washington is terrific. I don't want to go there. Yeah, there's so many people. And if you'd like to pull anybody out, Alice Waters, we obviously getting to know, we know her, and certainly she's been a part of the history of food and the understanding of food for so long. Is there anybody you would like to sort of focus on a little bit?
I mean, Karen Washington is remarkable. I mean, she is, you know, was a, I think she worked as a physical therapist and had a big lot in the South Bronx and started to try to grow food herself and just sort of fell in love with the process of growing food and also realized that it tasted delicious to grow her own food because she was doing it in a healthy way. And she's the founder of Black Urban Growers in New York. She has a small forum upstate called Rise and Root Farms. And she's an activist and speaks all over, you know, the country about sort of, I mean, everything from regenerative farming. And she teaches it, but also teaches the history of what we did to BIPOC farmers, what we've done to them. I mean, what we did is we essentially took land away from them, you know, either by certain not observing kind of deeds and wills, or by predatory lending practices. And the USDA explicitly did this. You know, I mean, when you really hear the story, it's remarkable. It's horrifying. You know, and one of the things we're trying to do in the new farm bill is, you know, get more money for BIPOC farmers.
Yeah, all we have to do is go back to before the Civil War with slavery and farming, the relationship to the African American community. And then even after that, it is a history of sharecropping, which was essentially slavery 2.0, and essentially not giving those people what they were promised, the opportunity to farm their own land. That's crazy. Yep. I want to talk about Brent Smith, because what a cool story. What a great coda at the end of the film for there's a lot of people at the end of the film, you know, you can throw the confetti for a lot of them on this one, but I love what he's doing as well.
Oh, and he's amazing. So he used to be a conventional fisherman and fished the world, basically. And then when, you know, the cod stocks crashed in Newfoundland, where he's from, he says he had sort of an environmental redemptive moment and decided to become a regenerative ocean farmer. So what he and his organization, Green Wave, do is they have their own farm, first of all. So they farm kelp, seaweed, and shellfish, which don't need any fertilizer, right? No fresh water. Right. They don't. And it's sustainable. And then it also sequesters carbon.
Yes.
So it's really remarkable. And then he sells the kelp and the shellfish, obviously, for food, but also the kelp is turned into bioplastics and other things. And he's really figured out how to have a diverse customer base as well, which is another thing we discovered in the pandemic, is that you need to have sort of a diverse business. So if one piece of your business isn't doing well, you can kind of turn to the next. But he's a remarkable person. The other thing that I love about Brent and his organization is they're dedicated to training other kelp farmers.
That's
So in what they've shown that it does, just like Will Harris in Bluffton, Georgia, is it revitalizes communities.
I like to say that nature left to its own devices will heal itself. right? If we give it a little bit of help, a little kick forward in terms of the speed by which it can happen, we are looking at it at an opportunity, because we now, with the science and the agricultural understanding, we know where we should be going. So that's the part that's frustrating. We know that this can be better. We can eat healthier food. We can produce more, and we don't have to destroy the planet in the process. We know how to do that.
And we can help people with their health. I mean, one in six Americans has a diet-related disease.
Yeah.
I mean, because they say, you know, I mean, people make this argument that, you know, they brag that we have the cheapest food in the world. I mean, we're not looking at the true societal costs, you know, of producing that cheap food.
We have the cheapest food, but we have the highest per capita amount of money spent on our healthcare in the world as well.
That's,
so yes,
correct.
Bob and Lee Jones, another great story. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about Food and Country is these people, they ooze the dedication that they have to what they do. And these are great examples of how they feel when because of the pandemic, what the people they had to lay off or to whatever it was, it's mm-hmm. comes through in so many of the people in this film. But I love Bob and Lee.
Yeah, no, they're terrific. And, you know, their sort of family history also tells the more recent story of farming in America. I mean, they lost their entire farm in the 80s, you know. So, you know, and the fact that they built it back by growing healthy, delicious vegetables. And they started selling at farmers markets, and then they grew and grew and grew. And they don't have to participate in, you know, that sort of the process that we describe in the film of going to the bank every year to get a loan. Because they've learned how to have revenue 12 months out of the year. Well, it's economic problems too. I mean, that's the thing that's so fascinating. It's really like a game changer. If like we could do these things on a much wider, broader basis, it just makes so much sense.
Absolutely. Well, Alice doing direct buying from farms. Mm-hmm. I'll just call him the guy with the cowboy hat. I can't think of his name right now. Steve Stratford. Again, comes from a cultural, sort of a cultural social perspective that may not initially, you might not think would be adaptive or embracing this, but that's changing because these people want to make money. They want to sustain their way of life. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, well, Angela and Carrie Knuth, the farmers, more conventional type farmers in Nebraska, I mean, the reason they're turning to organic, first and foremost, is economic. Yeah. They can make more money. And then once they do that, Angela also starts finding soil health, like making her soil health rewarding. They're not your kind of hippie farmer somewhere near Berkeley, right? They're very, very different, but it makes sense to any type of farmer to do this.
Yeah.
But it's expensive to start because it takes three years to transition a farm to true organic because you have to heal that soil. So it's you know, for most farmers, that's too long of a time to wait to make money.
Yeah. Well, we're going to let you go on this. I just, there's so much here. And one of the things, I watched it twice. And
oh,
I will tell you, no, well, and I'll tell you why. I mean, because it's so informative. There's a lot of information, but also I enjoyed the time I spent with the subject in the film, especially Ruth. I can't, you know, leave without giving her due in terms of her empathy that you can see in her interactions with these people.
Absolutely.
And she's a great guide into this world.
Yeah. Has so much knowledge. She has so much empathy. She also has, you know, this reporting acumen that she brings to the film, you know, so it was a really wonderful collaboration. And I feel very lucky I got to work with her on it.
Yeah. And I learned a lot.
Oh,
and that's another part of this. So, well, Laura Gabbert, thank you. Thank you so much for Food and Country. It's just a terrific film. And all the best. Again, it's in theaters now, so be looking for it. I know it's in Los Angeles. I believe it's going to play in the Royal and
The Lemley Monica and the Lemley Glendale. I believe those are the three. Yeah. And if you want to look for dates, foodandcountryfilm.com is a good place to go. It's coming to your city. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you so much. Again, we've been speaking with the director and co-producer of this wonderful film, Food and Country, and that would be Laura Gabbert. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Caspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.